Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
Arthur on this email says, hello there, went to see Brokeback Mountain last week on James King's recommendation.
Yeah, and James was quite right to recommend it because it's a wonderful thing.
Can I finish the email?
I
went to see it last week on James King's recommendation. Boring. That's over like half a page.
Yeah, yeah.
Typical romance that was just plain run-of-the-mill fluff. I don't see what the big deal is. It made me yearn for the days of Jar Jar Binks. The soundtrack was cool, though, says Arthur.
I thought it was lovely. I thought James's review was spot on. I mean, they've really worked hard to lose the gay Western tag, which the film had at the beginning, which did help it sell originally. And I know Ang Lee said he didn't like it because people thought that it sounded funny, it sounded Blazing Saddles-y. But I thought it was heartbreaking. I thought it was beautifully done. Great performances by Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal, both of whom I think deserve, you know, awards. It's beautifully shot. It's really moving. And actually, funnily enough, if you read the Annie Proulx source, which is very short, I've not been a huge fan of her writing, and I read that that old Ace in the Hole, which is incredibly long and fairly dull, and I thought it was a really beautiful adaptation of that story, and I think it's lovely, and I think it deserves the awards it gets. And there was a little protest about it. It just won another award during the week, and people were protesting about it, and there's some cinema in, I think it's Salt Lake City, which has banned it, and all that sort of thing just makes you think, well, it's more of a reason to go see it.
The box office top 10 at 10, March of the Penguins,
which I think we've covered in some depth, and apparently I'm no longer allowed to ask how they got out of the water, because apparently that is a closed book. Not the penguins, the fish.
No, but those zoologists who are waiting with their PhDs.
They are.
They've been very busy, and we've done that. Mm. The producers at 9.
You know, good film originally, good stage play apparently, bad film secondly. I mean, I just don't know how they've managed to do it so badly, but it's not a good film.
Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, this week's number 8.
You know, a good piece of work, not as good as the third one, better than numbers 1 and 2. But something I hadn't pointed out before, which I should mention, is the special effects really are terrific. And for the first time, they've really got a handle on the flying sequences. And that is worth mentioning because it's, you know, from a special effects point of view, it's a great piece of work.
Bit theatrical, bit stagey in place.
Yeah, I know, you weren't a fan, were you?
Well, they all stand around in perfectly composed groups all the time.
But it's, you know, it's Harry Potter. I think that the theatricality is kind of inherent in the material. But it's not as good as Prisoner of Azkaban, which is the best of them. And I think, to be honest, is going to be a very hard act to match for the rest of them.
Match Point this week, 7.
You know, it's very odd. Critics around the world have loved Match Point. And I'm kind of confused and slightly disappointed by it. It's cross-generic in a way which is rather complicated. It starts out as a sort of romantic drama and then turns into not a murder mystery, but a murder story. And it felt very much to me like Crimes and Misdemeanors light. I have to say, as somebody, I don't live in London, obviously, now, but as somebody who did used to live in London, I did get the feeling of it's the postcard, you know, there's the gherkin, there's the wheel. Oh, I've got to go and meet somebody in the Tate Modern. You know, now I'm sure that if you live in New York, you could say exactly the same thing about Manhattan or Annie Hall. But I was very unsatisfied by it. And I'm surprised by just how well it's been received.
No, I thought you'd finished.
I was going to say, you know, it's not...
It was unlike you to pause for breath, you know.
Yeah, it's just because it's kind of confused me so much. I really don't get the adulation for it. I mean, but people are heaping awards nominations on it as well.
Cheaper by the Dozen 2, speaking of lots of awards.
Yeah, exactly. I imagine this is going to show up in the Razzies somewhere. I mean, the first one was lousy. The second one is pointless.
Just Like Heaven, this week's 5.
Just Like Hell. Boy, that's a grim movie. And two people I really like. Reese Witherspoon, she's, you know, generally quite good, and she's really, really good in the forthcoming Johnny Cash biopic, which, incidentally, put it on your calendars now as one of the...
That.
Oh, boy, it's really good. It's really... It's up there with the Buddy Holly story, and I don't say that lightly.
So... It's a good impression, or is it a good impersonation, or is it...
The impersonations are absolutely fantastic. His version of Johnny Cash is great, but just as a film, it's just a terrific piece of work. Just Like Heaven, awful, awful, horrible.
I'm out of touch. Brokeback Mountain at 4.
You know, lovely, luscious, gorgeous, very moving, very physical, which I think is a very brave thing. They don't mess around about the relationship, but in the end, terribly melancholic, but in a very good way. Ang Lee's a very interesting director. He's a cultural outsider who really has got very interesting take on American culture.
Just Friends at 3.
You know, James kind of liked this, didn't he? I mean, you had to push him because you had the blokey, what's he called, Ryan Thingy Bob.
Ryan Thingybob
on. And then afterwards you say, well, you haven't any... James sort of said, well, I think he's the best thing in the movie, which he is, but really, that's not saying much at all. It's like saying there's a bit of the toilet that doesn't stink as much as the rest of the toilet. I mean, it's toilet.
The Chronicles of Narnia, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
You know, still wowing the kids, still playing very young, still nothing like, any of the Lord of the Rings movies. But it is sweet. My kids have got a great fondness for it. And I've kind of become addicted to the score because I've got a soundtrack CD thing of the score, which just plays on a constant loop in our house now. So I can't get that out of my head.
And the UK box office number one is still King Kong.
3 hours worth of top quality Peter Jackson. Yes, it's long. Yes, it takes a long time to get to the eight, but Andy Serkis is fab. The special effects are really good. Yes, there's stuff that isn't necessarily inherent to the narrative.
Well, that's skating on the pond.
The skating on the pond thing bothers you more than it bothers me, because by the time we got to the skating on the pond, frankly, I wasn't worrying about whether the ice was going to crack.
I was expecting Father Christmas to appear.
Yeah, but it's King...
Played by Richard Attenborough.
Well, I'm not going to say it's flawless, because it clearly isn't. There are clearly many things wrong with it. One of them being, you're worried about the pond, but how do they get how do they get King Kong on the boat? That's passed over really beautifully.
With a winch.
No, but the boat would capsize. Have you seen the size of him? He's, like, huge. But
that's
Andy Serkis
point,
is great, and it's worth it for his performance. Okay. And actually, the stuff at the end on the top of the Empire State Building is really great. Stop rolling your eyebrows. I've been away for a couple of weeks. I have stuff to catch up.
Okay,
nice
so...
Nice to see you too. Welcome back, Mark. No, none of that happens. You're just straight in. Do you want to tell the listeners what Sister Helen Prejean said when you went outside?
She said... You do look tired. And I said, it's okay. I always look like this. And then as I was just coming back into the studio, I heard her say to you, does he always look like this?
And I said, yes. She said, he must get a lot of sympathy for it.
Kind of went off her at that point. So there's a lot of releases this week. Memoirs of a Geisha up first.
Okay, Rob Chicago. I mean, you remember what I thought of Chicago, which was not great. Marshall's adaptation of a novel by Arthur Golden, which at one point was slated to be directed by Steven Spielberg, who then didn't direct it, but he ends up with a producer credit on it now. The story of a young girl who is taken from her family in a fishing village winds up being trained as a geisha, and it follows her life story through all the trials and tribulations being taken away through from her family, being trained as a geisha, what then happens during the war, blah, 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 blah. So it's episodic, epic. Obviously, Japanese story. However, there's been a lot of fuss about it. Partly, it's all shot in Hollywood and America. There must be some external stuff that's shot elsewhere, but almost all of it is done in interiors in Hollywood. And, of course, the central people in the cast are... Well, Zhang Ziyi, who's now officially being referred to as Ziyi Zhang, because you know there's a whole thing that you put the...
Changed it around, yeah.
Yeah, fine, okay. So since 2046, I think she now prefers to be called Ziyi Zhang. Well, she's Chinese and is known best from House of Flying Daggers, and she's up for a Golden Globe. Gong Li, who is also Chinese, who's known best from Raise the Red Lantern, and Michelle Yeoh, who I think is in Tomorrow Never Dies, and is actually a very, very well-known Hong Kong actress because she's originally Malaysian. And there was some fuss about, well, only Hollywood could have done this, taken this story and messed it around by, you know, casting these... Well, you know, who cares? It's like, it's a Hollywood movie. If what you're looking for is something terribly purist, then actually go and watch a Japanese movie or watch a Malaysian movie or watch a Hong Kong movie. Let's be absolutely clear about this. It's a Hollywood movie from a source which is written by a bloke who lives in Boston. So as far as the authenticity of the Memoirs of a Geisha bit is concerned, let's just put that to one side and let's just take it for what it is. It's a better film than Chicago, which I didn't rate, but then went on to, I think, didn't Chicago win Best Film? I mean, despite the fact Chicago had Richard Gere dancing in it, and I'm a big Richard Gere fan, as I think we've covered in some detail, it is a better film than that. From a production point of view, it's very well designed. Certainly, when you're looking at it, you don't think this is shot in America. What you think is this is shot in Hollywood. Everything looks like a Hollywood melodrama movie. Very bright colours, very bold colour schemes, extraordinary costume design, great makeup and hair, swishy camera moves. Every single scene, you know what you're saying about the Harry Potter movie, about they're constantly standing in what look like sort of posed tableaus? Well, there's an awful lot of that in Memoirs of a Geisha, and actually it serves the story perfectly well. It's fairly true to the novel, which I haven't read, but apparently what you see at the end of the film, which looks for all the world like a Hollywood ending, and I went, oh, well, you know, that clearly that's not in the novel. Apparently it is in the novel. Apparently the novel is very much much following exactly the same arc as the film. So all the problems that are inherent in it, in terms of the fact that it's melodramatic, that it's kind of cod, that it's kind of swishy, that it's kind of overblown, are all inherent in the source matter. So what you're then left with is, okay, it's a great big Hollywood costume drama, melodramatic triumph of love with cultural input story. And as those go, it's not bad. The performances, when you consider that what you've actually got is a bunch of very, very fine actresses all talking in, you know, what is not their mother tongue, some of them doing it better than others, but it's always a strange thing when you're casting foreign actors to talk in English. You know, I mean, I have no problem with subtitles, but I understand that the general rule is that, you know, mainstream audiences don't like subtitles. Actually, of course, anyway, because it's a multiracial cast, their mother tongues would all be varying because there are many different languages in which they could be speaking. So, they're all speaking in English, but you have to just get over that. In the same way that you get over, you know, in Schindler's List with Rafe, speaking in a German accent like this because he is Rafe Fiennes, but he just has a little bit of, you know, it's fine. After a while, you just think, it's okay, I'm just going to put up with the conceit of that's what it sounds like and I'm not bothered about it. It's not deep. It's not culturally important. It's not anything other than a good-looking piece of fluff, but it's a well-executed, good-looking piece of fluff that has huge, you know, melodramatic ambitions. And incidentally, I have nothing against melodrama. That's perfectly fine. It does have a couple of great performances. I think it'd be nice to see... Aziz Zhang is already up for a Golden Globe, and it'd be nice to see her up for some other awards as well. Michelle Yeoh's terrific, but, I mean, I defy anyone to tell me about a film in which she's not terrific, even when the films aren't that great. And Rob Marshall, having gone from being somebody who liked the cut every 10 seconds. Remember in Chicago, the worst thing was you couldn't see where they were dancing because it was cut so heavily. There was none of that artistry that you get, for example, in a Fred Astaire movie in which it's a single shot and the guy's doing it. Or Gene Kelly. I mean, Gene Kelly would always choreograph those things so that you could see the dancer was actually doing the dance. Well, in Chicago, it's like 1 foot down, cut, 1 foot down, cut. Well, you know, you can make anyone a good dancer. This time he's taken his time, he's stepped back, nicely paced, slightly overlong perhaps, but perfectly all right. Nothing to write home about, but perfectly all right.
Tsai Chin, who plays the auntie, plays failed geisha, she was in for a couple of weeks ago, and I at the end of the conversation, I still didn't quite understand, maybe the film explains, why wealthy people would spend the equivalent of hundreds of pounds to spend an evening with a geisha.
Well,
enjoying witty jokes and bad enough.
The movie goes at some length to attempt to explain geisha culture to a Western audience, as indeed does the novel. And what it comes down to, and the central thing is that, and the movie makes this very clear, it is not on an equivalency with prostitution, because actually there's a moment in the movie when the Americans arrive and that's when everything starts to go hideously wrong. It is a completely different... Now, obviously, to me, it's an alien concept, but it's an alien concept which is being put forward basically by a Western filmmaker from an author who lives in Boston. So it's very... I don't think, for example, that if you knew anything actually about geisha culture... I mean, for example, if you ask Tony Raines, who is clearly the country's leading expert on Asian movies, whether or not the version of geisha culture that is put forward in Memoirs of a Geisha is authentic, he would probably fall off his chair laughing. What you're getting is a Hollywood version of it.
If they had used Japanese actors,
yeah,
and they were able to film it in Japan,
yeah,
would that have made it better, do you think?
Well, I mean, it would have been a totally different movie. It's a Hollywood production. It's not even to do with the cast. It's just to do with the fact that it is at heart a Steven Spielberg Hollywood production, and that's what it is. And I don't see why people have a problem with that. That is what it is. If you want a Japanese movie, go see Zatoichi. If you want a Chinese movie, you know, go and see a Zhang Yimou film. I mean, this is not. It's a Hollywood movie.
Tom in Balham, with reference to previous conversations, Andy Serkis as Lumpy the Cook in King Kong.
Yes.
He's lumpy and clearly can't act his way out of a paper bag.
I think he clearly can't cook. Oh, I see. He's lumpy as an actor. No, he's not.
That'd be
silly.
Can't act his way out of a paper bag. He's good at mimicking the ape, though. I'll give him that. Tom, not quite convinced by your...
Andy Serkis's greatest performance is in 24 Hour Party People, in which he plays, the Rob Hammond, the producer from Factory Records. Absolutely brilliant.
Mark in Cardiff. Is it just me, or is Cillian Murphy turning into Pete Burns? Can we expect a Scouse accent and gorilla coats to feature in his next movie? Oh, hum. Mayo at bbc.co.uk.
I haven't seen Pete Burns in years. What's he doing?
He's on. Oh dear, you need a television.
Okay. Oh, he's in. He's with George Thingy Bob, isn't he? Yeah. What does he look like now?
Finger on the pulse of popular culture.
Okay. Sorry.
This email from Michael Adams. Simon, tell Mark to give Just Like Heaven a break. Before Christmas, my 7-year-old daughter was dragged along to see Goblet of Fire. scary, and Narnia, dull, then suddenly scary, then dull again. Actually, I quite like that as a way of describing movies. I wonder if it was be possible to identify movies, you know, boring, more boring, funny bit, sad bit.
Well, there is a graph, isn't there? The Total Film used to do a graph, which was like exciting, fall asleep, you know, car chase. They used to do, you know, like a graph of how the movie went.
I think it's a challenge. I think people should take this to heart. For example, what's this film, Mark?
Go on.
Wet, boring, wetter, more boring, about as wet as it's possible to get, still boring.
Just Like Heaven.
No, it's The Piano.
Oh, well, yeah. No, but then cheer as the piano gets thrown overboard.
All right, so then Michael continues. Anyway, I was basically none too impressed with these supposed kids' films. She therefore chose our family film trip last weekend, and Julie chose Just Like Heaven. All four of us, me, girlfriend, two daughters, absolutely loved it. Mm. It is completely harmless, nice, safe, family fair. There's nothing wrong with this. After Narnia, we all felt empty and ripped off. This film restored our faith in the family film.
Well, it just goes to show there's no such thing as a right answer other than mine.
Which is pretty much the refuge that I... Refuge.
The refuge, I think you're right, the first
that
time.
I was expecting. Okay, so Geisha is out. What else do we
need? Since you brought up the subject of Pete Burns, we'll move on to Cillian Murphy. Can I just say that the most important thing about Pete Burns, who you're quite right, is on that never... Whatever. What is it? I'm a celeb... No, brother
Big
thing.
Brother.
Big Brother. Is that Pete Burns is very important in the career of Bananarama, because it was after hearing You Spin Me Right Round that the Bananas said, I want to make a record that sounds like that, and that's how they ended up with Stock, Egg and a Watermelon.
Are there some films we can talk about?
Yeah, no, I'm just mentioning this to keep this alive. Okay, Cillian Murphy. The latest movie from Neil Jordan, who, of course, was a guest on the show not so long ago, came on with the DVD release of Company of Wolves. Breakfast on Pluto, starring Cillian Murphy in absolutely barnstorming form as a young boy who grows up in Ireland, has transsexual urges, runs away from his home, goes off to, you know, big glitzy London, where his paths cross with a number of characters, including a strange cabaret magician played by Stephen Ray, who's always worth the price of entrance, a homicidal womble played by Brendan Gleeson in a role which is really, you'd have to see the film to understand why. Yeah, he's a guy who dresses up as a womble, but he's, you know, he's also a guy underneath the womble costume. So you do get the scene of the drunken fighting womble, which is actually very good. An IRA gun runner. Now, the film starts and ends with Sugar Baby Love, which is one of my favourite records of all time, because let's...
The Rubettes.
No, I love the Rubettes. I've got five Rubettes albums.
Brian Ferry wasn't in that?
No. I've got five Rubettes albums, and in fact, the guy who did the lead vocals on the Rubettes, Paul Da Vinci, one of the great unsung singing voices of this country. Fantastic singer. Anyway, so it starts and ends with Sugar Baby Love, which I absolutely love. It's got a punchy womble in it, which is obviously a good thing. It's got the mix of transvestism and politics and sexuality, which would define The Crying Game, which was pretty much Neil Jordan's biggest hit. It's from a source novel by Pat McCabe, who was also the source behind The Butcher Boy, which many critics, and I'm one of them, think is easily one of Neil Jordan's best films. And it's got this terrifically barnstorming central performance by Cillian Murphy, who's a great actor. We all know that he was so good in Red Eye, and, you know, now finally is being recognised. The question is, with all those things going for it, why is it that the movie doesn't actually hold together? Because in the end, you come away from it thinking it's a collection of parts, and the sum, the whole, is less than the sum of the parts. I remember it as fragments, great moments, great musical choices, great camera moves, great costumes, lovely scenes, but together, somehow not hanging together as a whole. It doesn't have anything like the narrative thread of The Crying Game. It doesn't have anything like the emotional consistency of Butcher Boy. I mean, the thing with Neil Jordan is it's admirable that having made as many mainstream hits as he has, and having made his movies which are as glossed as they are, that he is able to make something as ragged as Breakfast on Pluto. But it is ragged and it is ramshackle, and in the end, it doesn't add up to what it ought to add up to. I'm not saying don't go and see it, because there's certainly enough in there to grab your attention. I would say almost just the fact of Cillian Murphy's performance, because I think he is really something, and the beginning and ending with Sugar Baby Love. But you will come away from it feeling sort of slightly unsatisfied, like it never really got off the starting blocks. It's a lot of bits, but that's not enough. So it's not classic. It's not terrible. There are great things about it, but in the end, it left me feeling a little bit like the central character. It doesn't really know what it wants to be, and it ends up kind of all dressed up and all made up, but with nowhere really to go.
Might it be leading to a Rubettes revival?
Well, I mean, you know, Muriel's Wedding started with Sugar Baby Love, and I thought, this is it. Suddenly, they can all dust down their caps, and we can all get Where It's At on CD, but of course, I don't think anyone's ever released Where It's At on CD, which is really annoying, because my vinyl copy's completely knackered.
Funny that. You must have the only worn-out copy, presumably still in existence.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of them. I've got the, you know, they made four, then they went off to France. They made four really good albums. Then they went off to France. Then, of course, they had a big gay rights single, you know, Under One Roof, which I think didn't get airplay over here, but
You've
was very big in Europe.
Already surpassed most people's Rubettes knowledge. Mm-hmm. We don't really need any more.
Nope.
More movies to come. All Mark's reviews available as a podcast. You can go to the BBC Five Live website for all the details, and iTunes will help you as well. I suppose Jarhead is going to be one of the big movies of the week. Certainly lots of posters.
Lots of posters, lots of awards attention. A Gulf War One drama directed by Sam Mendes from a novel by Anthony Swofford, which again I haven't read. Jake Gyllenhaal, who of course is out in Brokeback Mountain at the moment, which if I didn't cover this before is a really, really good film, and go see it.
Not boring,
it's great.
At all?
No, not in the slightest bit boring. Really moving. Oh, well, I'm obviously boring if you're completely emotionally stilted. But other than
Excellent.
That, really good.
Just checking.
Just checking. In a role which originally Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire apparently both up for, he is the title Jarhead Grunt. You know, jarhead meaning empty head, also because they have the shaved heads of the
Anthony
head.
Anthony Swofford was on a couple of days ago.
Okay, fine. Was he nice?
Yeah, he was.
Okay, fine.
He explained pretty much everything going, I think.
Well, basically what happens is exactly what you expect to happen. He goes, he gets trained, they get sent to the Gulf War, nothing happens. And that's pretty much the tone of it. It's the usual thing, you know, war is awful. You get the parade of, you know, bullying, latrine cleaning, depression, drunkenness, self-abuse, lots and lots of swearing. Apparently 278 uses of the F word. 38 of them with the M word prefix, so that's a lot of swearing. The first half of it is basically...
That's the melon farmer word.
It is the melon farmer word. I love that.
Did you count?
No, it's on a site.
Helpfully provided.
No, because, I mean, I have better things to do than to count the F words in, but somebody has done it. I mean, you know, God bless the Internet Movie Database, 278.
So it's not going to be Penguins, Narnia, Jarhead as a choice?
I don't think so. No. So first half... It's not Full Metal Jacket, but it kind of wants to be, and it's the usual stuff of the grunts being shouted at and being abused by the trainer. I mean, look, I really like Lou Gossett Jr. in An Officer and a Gentleman. I really like J. Lee Ermey in Full Metal Jacket. I don't really need to see all that stuff all over again. Then they go out to the Gulf. It's beautifully shot. The cinematography is absolutely lovely. It's very well edited. It's edited by Walter Mirsch, who, of course, famously worked on Apocalypse Now. And there's one kind of interesting, controversial sequence in which the grunts all sit down and watch Apocalypse Now. They watch the Ride of the Valkyrie sequence in it to get sort of juiced up for war. And you think that what's happening here is that Sam Mendes is making a comment about the way in which films that appear to be anti-war films are actually taken on board as war, as pro-war films. There's another moment in which they sit down and try to watch The Deer Hunter, which incidentally is a terrible film. The Deer Hunter is a really lousy, evil, rubbish, badly edited...
What?
The Deer Hunter is an awful film. It's terrible. I mean,
how did we get here?
Because they try and watch The Deer Hunter, and then it turns out that somebody's recorded pornography over it, so they don't watch The Deer Hunter, which, I mean, honestly, if somebody had recorded a blank screen over it, but The Deer Hunter is a lousy film. What on earth were the Academy Awards thinking about when they went, oh, let's get Michael Cimino's masterpiece? Yeah, Michael Cimino, look what happened to him. Heaven's Gate. You know, it's
Robert De Niro?
I'm sorry, Robert De Niro in not very good form. Christopher Walken in one role that will live with him forever and ever form. And I think it is genuinely racist, that film. But anyway, let's
stick
not go
with
there.
Jarhead.
Fine. So Jarhead isn't any of those things. Jarhead has got all its politics in the right place. Going to the Gulf is a really, really difficult thing. Everything's complicated. The guys on the ground don't understand the situation. It's all terrible. They all get abused. And at the end, they leave saying, well, thank heaven, we're never going to have to come back here again, to which you can virtually hear the audience going, boom, and if you will, boom. Now, my problem with it is, it's all perfectly well executed. Actually, it's very nicely executed, but it's just like, and your point is, it's like, I was discussing this with David. David here at Radio 5 in the office earlier on was saying, it's like...
Are we interested in that?
Just because I'm about to say something that if I say it now and it sounds like I made it up, then he will give me a hard time afterwards for having nicked this.
Do
off
I care?
Him. Well, I'm just clear,
who else
you know,
have you discussed it
covering
with who I don't know.
Just David, okay? So this comment, copyright David. You know that Nick Cage movie about the arms dealers that said all arms dealers are really bad and evil and the arms trade is really bad and evil? It's like that. You go, yeah, and... So that's it. So Jake Gyllenhaal and everyone up for awards, and I think it's a perfectly workable movie that goes along and then stops.
I'm glad you told us about David.
But
anyway.
Inconsequential... is not in it. I mean, it's just, it's like, here we go again.
When you said its politics are all in the right place, you mean its politics agree with yours?
No, its politics are that war, under any circumstances is a horrible endeavour, and being in a battlefield is a horrible thing. And actually, on the ground, it's incredibly confusing. And for the people who are in the firing line, the arguments about, you know, imperialism or lack of imperialism are all kind of irrelevant.
Are you saying Boy George was right? War is
stupid, and people are stupid, and people who start wars are really stupid.
OK. So, can you...
So, not great. Moving on. Can I
is that
on?
What David thinks as well?
No, I don't know what he thinks. Okay. He just referred to... You can bring him in if you want. No, it was just, in reference to another movie. So
which of these movies, then? Thank you for the latest selection for Mark to try and work out. Most of these are good and quite straightforward, I would suggest. Kareem in London. Coincidences, singing frogs.
Coincidences, singing frogs. Magnolia.
On. Yes, of course.
Right.
This is, again, very... You've got to do better than this, Derek.
What do you mean you've got to do better than this? I just got two of them. Oh, they've got to do better. Are you talking to me or the audience?
When I look at you, I'm talking to you.
Okay. That's me doing Robert De Niro.
Very good, but not very well.
No.
On an off day. Mm. Road trip, spookiness, chainsaw, death, skulls, more death, more chainsaw, cooking, grandpa.
Yeah, Jeepers Creepers. Oh, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yes, Texas
Chainsaw Massacre. Well, actually, reference. Although, interestingly enough, could also be Jeepers Creepers, but actually, no, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Peter, wet, dark, wet, dark, wet, then dry and bright in the undirector's cut.
Blade Runner.
Yes, very good.
I'm really not doing badly. I'm impressing even myself.
And Steve with this, quiet. And then he puts non. Not quite sure why. Non, maybe. Quiet.
Silent movie, Mel Brooks.
There you go.
Thank you. So, and who is it who says the non? It is Marcel Marceau.
Oh, of course.
That's
okay,
the gag. It's silent movie. It's the gag. Non.
I have it now. 85058, if you could be quick on these, mail at bbc.co.uk.
Okay, two horror movies out this week. Cry Wolf, one of those Dumbo teen horror movies. There's a group of high school students. They decide to make up an urban myth about a serial killer running around with an orange ski mask. And guess what? Their urban myth starts to come true and he pursues them. Or are they, in fact, all just playing tricks on each other? Scream has got an awful lot to answer for. Scream resurrected the ghost of the teenage slasher movie. And it did this very postmodern dissection on it. It was very funny. It was great. We thought, you know, really, someone's now done something interesting with those awful 70s, 80s, you know, teen slasher movies. But somehow the genre then got legs and started up again. And we got all those I Still Don't Care What You Did Last Summer movies. And now here's the sort of dog end of it all. They're all meant to be cine literate and they all meant to understand about urban myths. But it's just like, oh, there's a bunch of teenagers being chased around by a guy in a mask, not very well. It's not intelligent enough to be interesting. It's not witty enough to be funny. And it's not nasty enough to be scary. So that's a bit pointless, isn't it? It cost about $1 million. The Roost looks like it cost a lot less than that, although, you know, one can never tell with these things. And it's not great, but it is better. If you're going to see a horror movie this week, I would go for The Roost rather than Cry Wolf. Again, bunch of teenagers or 20-somethings in a car, driving along a road, car stops, barn, bats, blood-sucking, you know, all that sort of stuff. The interesting thing
about... bats in the barn?
Yeah, the bats are on the top of the barn, and then they get into the barn, and then it's zombies, you know. So, but it's not great.
Where do the zombies come from?
The bats bite them and they become zombified. It's just a hot
zombies
push.
In the barn with the bats.
Well, what do you mean, are the zombies in the barn? If the people who are in the barn are zombies, then the zombies are in the barn. But are they actually zombies? It's a kind of vampire-y thing, really. Anyway, the key thing I'm trying to say in the 2 minutes that I have to go is that the most interesting thing about the film is that there's this little wraparound segment with Tom Noonan, which is like a Frightmare introduction.
You know, Tom Herman's Hermits?
No, he's the guy from... Yes, very good. He's the guy from Manhunter. He's the guy from Manhunter. He's Tom Dolleheide in Manhunter, and he's really, really good. And he does this very good wraparound segment in which he introduces the movie in the style of Vampira, in the style of those, you know, welcome to the Fright Festival, blah, blah, blah. And actually, those bits are good. The rest of the movie is fairly disposable, and it's just off-the-peg stuff, but it's cheap off-the-peg stuff, and I would rather have it than Cry Wolf. And finally...
But he knows when he's into something good.
Does he know when he's... Is that No Milk Today? Is that Herman's Hermits?
I think so.
No Milk Today.
Before My Time.
Funnily enough, the editor of Fangoria's wife's favourite band are Herman's Hermits.
So, does the editor of Fangoria's wife know David?
She might do. Do you know Marguerite Timpone? You do. OK, so there we go. OK, and very quickly, there's a little British movie out called The Truth, about a bunch of people that go to a remote Scottish Highlands place where they're having a kind of find-yourself session, and then somebody dies, and then it kind of turns into The Wicker Man meets instant enlightenment, including VAT, although not in a good way. And it's one of those really odd little things. When you're sitting there watching it, you think, either this is really terrible, or it's really quirky, or It's really adventurously quirky, but actually quite terrible.
You're quite indecisive on the day you
saw it. Well, I think in the end, the answer is it has an audience of no one at all. So it's really going to be down to me, you, and anyone else who saw it, because it's going to be here and gone. But it's very, very odd. And some of it is really lousy. Some of it's quite interesting.
All right. Have you done?
Yep, done.
Patrick's suggested, could you work this one out? Introspection, self-harm, spooks, Wagner, surf, bald, bang, end.
Do it again.
Introspection, self-harm, spooks, Wagner, being the big clue, surf, bald, bang, end.
Apocalypse Now.
Is correct.
OK.
For 5 points. Movie of the week?
Actually, oddly enough, Breakfast on Pluto, for all the things that are wrong with it. Memoirs of a Geisha, much more mainstream, but Breakfast on Pluto, it's an adventurous mess.